Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to Books and Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Lynn Pettinger from the University of Warwick about her new book, Work, Consumption, and Capitalism, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan in December 2015. So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Lynn Pettinger, who is an associate professor in sociology at the University of Warwick. And we're going to be talking about her new book, Work, Consumption, and Capitalism, which was published by Palgrave in 2016. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here.
This is a really interesting book because it tries to make accessible a whole range of debates about contemporary life, contemporary consumption, and to connect them up with production and work. And one of the ways you do this is through a series of really accessible examples. Before we get into that, I'm quite interested in where the project came from. And so what gave you the idea to write about this?
It's been a really long time in the making, and a little bit of that is because wanting to make it accessible means really having to pay quite a lot of attention to the style of writing, so a lot of rewriting. But it's also because I really wanted it to be an interdisciplinary book, and that meant learning some literature in quite disparate kinds of fields, as well as the subfields within my own current discipline, which is sociology. So knowing the literature on sociology of work, and also knowing something on sociology of consumption, and understanding economic sociology. So, I mean, it's got a long, in some sense, a really long trajectory coming out of my early studies, because things do, you know, those early studies are really formative of where you end up. I had a degree in politics and economics, and then I discovered sociology as something that made so much more sense of the world around me, partly because of its much greater openness. And my PhD was on retail working, and I was exploring the importance of branded organisations for understanding what kinds of work sales assistants ended up doing. And I never really wanted to write the book of that PhD, but some of those ideas around the production of consumption, which was the title I was kind of always working with, although it's not the title on the book, but the idea about the way in which work is involved and intrinsic to making a consumer culture was the starting point of the book, and it came out of that. And then obviously things take a long time, and I'm a slow thinker, so things took a long time to be able to form in such a way that they could become, you know, a series of 9 related chapters that covered things that are not normally kept put together in a way that hopefully kind of makes sense of a particular bit of consumer capitalism.
Can you introduce those kind of core ideas that you bring together? The thing you do at the start of the book is you talk about genes as a way of kind of thinking through almost the kind of entirety of the book's project.
Yeah, genes are good to think with. And I think that particularly in some elements of anthropology, but in some sociology as well, there's an emerging desire to kind of follow the product as a way to understand the complexity of partly of supply chains and of how production happens. So how things go from the raw material of cotton and indigo dyes into factories where they are formed as denim, and then how they are cut and sewn into jeans and then sold. And so jeans make it possible to think about those kind of material forms of production, But because they make it also possible to think about branding and fashion and personal identity, then they get to be just a great example. And I'm a sociologist, but I'm a fan of anthropology in particular. Who doesn't love Daniel Miller?
Yeah.
So his Global Genes project with Sophie Woodward just struck me as providing some ideas, which I then looked for some other readings about denim in order to tell a story about how genes get produced and how they get consumed, to pull out some of the big themes of the book. So we can locate something really ordinary and mundane within global structures of capitalism. And because every time I've asked my students, how many of you own genes? Maybe two don't own a pair of jeans, but so they're good to think with.
The other thing that the introduction to the book does, as well as kind of giving us this really everyday and almost normal example of these big themes, is to try and draw some boundaries around what you're thinking about when you're thinking about work. There's a very kind of specific type of work and how it relates to consumption more generally. So can you kind of tease out those boundaries?
Sure. I mean, the boundaries are always fuzzy. But boundaries are always best when they're fuzzy, when you don't have too strict a sense of what the typology should be. And it's back to this idea of the production of consumption. So I wanted to think about what forms of work might go into producing a consumer culture, and think particularly about those that in some way contributed to the production of meaning and therefore to the production of economic value. And that led me to pull together forms of work that are not normally considered as in any way comparable. So the obvious forms of work that are not considered comparable, which are really significant in the book, are work like advertising, branding, and marketing, which we might frame as creative labour, as culture work, but which I would prefer probably to think of as cultural intermediary work. But to put those alongside service sector work, which was the point of entry into the project for me. And although we have to recognise that those are kind of radically different in some ways, in terms of rates of pay, in terms of levels of autonomy, educational background of people who end up doing it, and also in terms of kind of the permanence of the work and its kind of structural position within the labour market and economic structures, nonetheless, what they share and what it seemed important to pull out a little bit is a real importance in contributing to the production of a consumer culture, so to making possible other people's consumption. So I wanted to use that to think about what those kinds of, how that might be produced. And that meant that I've got a range of kind of well-known and easily identifiable jobs like sales assistant to consider, to think about advertising and marketing not as just entities that are distant and abstract, but which are actually done by specific kinds of people, but also to draw attention to some of the kinds of jobs that David Graeber calls them bullshit jobs, jobs that don't necessarily, not necessarily been researched, that perhaps the world could live without. So my favourite is the cool hunter. So the person who goes out into urban spaces and looks up street style and tries to transform that into something that can be used in fashion industry, for example. But as well as the cool hunter, we might think of stylists and brand positioners. So there isn't lots of research on any of those kinds of occupations. So it's worth thinking of them under the lens of the cultural intermediary, I think, in order to see what might they be doing to make the consumer culture possible.
Now, one of the things you've alluded to quite a few times already in the discussion is this idea of kind of capitalism, global capitalism. And one of the things you do is kind of talk through quite clearly various different ideas about what capitalism means and how it helps us to understand production and consumption. I think the really useful thing in that is the way that there are particular ethical or perhaps moral implications attached to the particular theories of capitalism that we might be comfortable with and we might use. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that kind of ethical moral dimension to thinking through theories of capitalism, because it's important all the way through the book.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are multiple dimensions to it, and one of them is that my experience of working with students and thinking about issues of consumer culture, and my intended audience is students, although perhaps other people might find it interesting as well, is that they're interested in and concerned to understand their own practices in ethical and moral terms. So to frame ethical and moral relationships within capitalism struck me as significant. But kind of conceptually, it seems always to me important to notice the implicit normative position taking of academic work and to think that through, to acknowledge it, to see what implications and effects it might have for the kind of arguments and the kind of reasonings that scholars might be working with themselves. And as partly students might be thinking critically engaging with the work that they're reading. So when they're reading work, which they can start to identify as having been derived from a particular moral position, then they can assess it with that in mind. So what to say about that? I think the obvious example is that many scholars in this field are drawing their ideas from Marx and from Marxist thinkers and following on from that. And he's the easy example for thinking these kind of ethical questions through. So I make use of Albert O. Hirschman's ideas, framing and typology of economic thinking, to read Marx as claiming that destructive markets are implicitly what how we might think about capitalism, and to set that against other kinds of ways of thinking about capitalism as having different kinds of connotations, different kinds of moral effects. So I guess I'm thinking there that economics, which is a discipline which denies its moral range or its moral compass or the way in which it might be making implicit claims around the nature of what markets are doing, that claim to neutrality, it seems that attending to the ethics within that claim to neutrality is a really significant way to understand and to argue against some of the claims that economists might make about human action, about the rationality of decision making, about the claimed efficiency of markets and things like that. And in making that kind of statement, I'm showing something of my own positioning there. So drawing on Fourcade and Healy, who add a little fourth dimension to Hirschman's original three ways of dividing the moral status of economic thinking and economic ideas, to draw on their idea of the market as a moral project, so that markets do moral action, they don't just reflect or step outside of the society. And that's really insignificant to me, to thinking about how consumer capitalism is working.
I mean, the other two kind of ground-clearing moments in the book are thinking about explaining consumption and also accounting for ideas about work.
Mm.
And I mean, we've covered a little bit, you know, the kind of the idea about what work is, particularly in terms of how you define your use of things like cultural intermediaries. Mm. But I guess the thing we haven't thought about is what we mean by consumption. So yeah, I wonder if you could kind of account for consumption.
Account for consumption. I'm kind of tempted to say, ask me another question. What a big thing to have to do. We've got, I'm not actually certain when we would date the start of that, but certainly a shift within cultural studies and within the sociology to attend to consumption and to think about why it's important. So certainly in British sociology in the post-war period, industrial sociology dominated. This was a sociology of manufacturing, of workplaces, largely of men's form of work. And there was a lot of attention to that as a significant marker of identity. And I will always argue that work is a significant marker of identity, of social belonging, of meaning-making in the world. But I think that the shift to attending to consumption was important and was really worth doing. It's a crucial part of the stuff of social life. And it needs to be taken seriously because it is in itself serious. So you've asked me about the ethical dimensions of markets. So the ethical dimensions of the goods that we end up buying, how they've been produced, what environmental effects they might have, and what kinds of working conditions the people who produced it are worth attending to. But I think consumption is also worth attending to because it's frivolous and pleasurable. And so thinking that through and making sense of that. In sociology, I think the dominant way of thinking about it is that consumption is a source and a marker of identity, and that's important. I think more recent work that explores the ordinariness and the mundanity of consumption also matters as well. So toothpaste is an important an item of consumption, as branded denim might be. So we need to attend to that as part of the stuff and the fabric of everyday social practices. So there's that sociology of consumption that's worth attending to. I think where the book moves into other kinds of disciplines or related disciplines is in the way it attends to how consumption is kind of systematized. And I'm thinking here particularly about branding, but also I would think about the fashion system within that. So what kinds of markers of social difference are embodied or implicit in a brand? Are these illusory kinds of differences? What senses might they matter to people, and how might they matter to people? So that kind of how the kind of the business of consumption is organized is significant to understanding how people consume. And the other thing I'd want to really draw attention to is to the history and to the geography of consumption. And that's partly because comparison is wonderful. We can understand something of a particular phenomenon by thinking about what it is not. So in the discussion of consumption, I wanted to think a little bit about the emergence of a consumer culture, attend to the ways in which that might have happened at different temporal moments in different places, and think about what the meaning of that might be. And a theme running through the book, not always successfully, because the dominant source of research on consumption is in Western Europe and in English-speaking places, so North America in particular, and perhaps for good reason, because American brands are often globally dominant. But I wanted really to make sure that there were examples of consumer practices that were not just in Western Europe, because how can we speak about a consumer culture as a Western Europe if you visited Singapore or Dubai or you've seen any of those photos of mega malls? Then you know that that's just not a sustainable position at all. But what local differences are visible within that global kind of framing of consumption? Does Starbucks have the same meaning in Japan as it has in Seattle? And clearly it doesn't. But what's the nature of that kind of local difference? And what other kinds of forms of consumption might matter more if we're to understand consumer culture in Japan rather than just exporting American models? So it was something I wanted to attend to and to invite readers to think about themselves.
So one of the things you do in terms of kind of broadening out that focus, not just globally, but actually in thinking through elements of markets, production and consumption that really aren't attended to particularly well by economics at all, is to think about embodiment, bodies, and also affect and emotions.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could say a bit about how bodies and emotions play a role in work and consumption.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I start with a really banal observation, which is going to sound a little bit ridiculous, but if you're going to work, then you need a body. So from that sense, thinking about how bodies shape work, so and how work shapes the body, is the conceptual starting point for that kind of idea. And that makes it possible to think through some of the dimensions of what all contemporary work involves in my mind, but specifically the kinds of work that are involved in producing consumption involves. So that's things like the craft labour of work, it's knowledge work and what's needed by knowledge workers, it's the dimensions of emotional and aesthetic labour. So conceptually, the starting point would be what is now a very common rejection of the Cartesian position of mind-body dualism. So it doesn't make sense to think about work if we hold on to a divide between mental labour, which is elite and middle class or upper class labour, and manual labour, which is working class routine and mundane forms of labour. So some of the forms of work that I would be interested in, say fashion design or any kind of design, in fact, which in some framings would be labelled as knowledge work and have those connotations of requiring specialist skills, knowledges and expertises, and therefore implicitly work with the head, but impossible to do without sensory experiences of the materials that you're working with. So attending to that as craft labour by noticing what bodies do in order to be able to produce interesting, beautiful, desirable products struck me as really important, really interesting. So aesthetic judgments that a brand designer might make when they're thinking about redoing a logo and they want a colour that is, you know, modern and fresh. And so they're tacit jump decisions about what's the right green, what's the right grey. And green is a great one, actually. And I could rant for hours about what kinds of green are good greens. So not a green that connotes poison and slime, but a green that connotes freshness and nature or whatever it might be. So that's attention to tacit dimensions of skill. That's attention to the sensory and to the aesthetic and to their interplay. So knowledge workers are not free-floating brains, would be the simple way to think about it. But the other thing that really matters when we're thinking about the nature of work here is the figure of the consumer and its relationship to the worker. So if an advertiser is generating a campaign, who are they imagining as the consumer? To some extent, they're drawing on research with consumers because there's loads of research with consumers, focus group after focus group after focus group. But some of the creative labourers are also drawing on their sense of who the consumer might be. So that can be fellow feeling, putting yourself in someone else's shoes, or it can be thinking, well, what would my grandma want and how might I persuade to her? So that kind of like very kind of social relationship that's imagined and that is part of doing that work well is significant. And the other way in which the imagined consumer matters is, and this brings us back to the service work and why service work is an important part of the story, the imagined consumer is the person who the sales assistant is invited to identify with in order that the sales assistant stops being quite so bothered by how rude the customer has been to them. So you're upset by the coffee you've been made isn't very nice, so you're going to get shouted at. Well, all the training manuals, all the management rules are not to let on about that. And that's been well studied as emotional labour and involves a labouring body who's controlling feeling and that kind of thing. I think the crucial point I draw in relation to your question about consumption is that the consumer has to be imagined in order for that to be possible. So the figure of the consumer is a significant cultural figure.
I wonder if we could focus in on ethics in this, mm-hmm. because you described a series of situations that really have several moral or ethical implications and attachments and associations mm-hmm. Running throughout them. And chapter 8 returns to the kind of ethical concerns in the book. And you really, you know, try and talk about good jobs and good work. So what are they?
You know, well, I think that's a brilliant question and it's an impossible question. And it's one that I really would like to be able to answer. So if we think about like cosmetic sales workers, and I'm drawing here in my example on Paige Aland's study of cosmetic sales workers. So they are all women. They're working for global branded organisations. They're low paid. They're treated commonly very badly by customers because customers see them as lower status, uneducated, and there to provide service. So why is it that they get pleasure from their work, they enjoy their work? They are quoted in Land's study as commentating that getting work on a cosmetic sales desk is a form of affirmation of their beauty because women who are not attractive don't get those kinds of jobs, which is one of the subtle inequalities that emerges when you look at front-facing service work and consumer culture. So what does that make us think about what counts as a good job? If someone gets pleasure from it, they're making themselves up every day. They feel beautiful and powerful and attractive because of that. And there are lots of other kind of comparable studies in service sector work. So that, to my mind, raises questions around how sociologists of work have traditionally thought of what counts as a bad job. So a bad job is one where you're low paid and you have low status and you don't have much autonomy. And the sales assistants don't have any of those things, but they have something else, which is part of their connection to consumer culture. And that's why it's impossible for me to answer your question about what's a good job, because that's not my sense of what a good job is. But I can think my way into why the cosmetic salespeople might find that to be a kind of good job. So the kind of the role of or the positioning of work within the a wider sense of global consumer capitalism seems kind of significant. So we have other studies like Eileen Otis's accounts of hotel workers in China who feel like they gain status from understanding the cultural norms of how they should behave and then being able to dismiss the very rude and aggressive businessmen and things like that. So if you think about good workers, as autonomy, as freedom from excessive management, as are really important, then, and that's certainly something that in the literature on cultural intermediaries and creative labour comes out as really important. And they raise a dimension which I think is also present in accounts of service work, which is around the working conditions under which they are employed. So these are well documented, often instances of precarious labour, so looking for the next contract, all the networks that you have need to be constantly mobilised in order to be able to get that work, or you're working in some way where you're compromising on your creative or your aesthetic autonomy or preference in order to find a wage, in order to live. So in fashion designers, hoping to have your own label, but ending up working, designing children's clothes for a major chain store or something like that. So those kinds of precariousness, and I think it's also often connected to work intensity, so to long hours, to lots of effort that have to be put in, to unstable contracts and to an uncertainty over pay. But on the other hand, when you read interviews with creative workers, this is some of it celebrated and some of it they've been invited to celebrate, but it's desirable work. So again, that raises questions around the nature of decent work and what that might involve. And taking it back to the example of jeans, underpinning this is also the work that I don't really study, but I think is significant and is impossible to imagine consumer culture without, which is the labour of production. So who's working in supply chains, who's growing the cotton, picking the cotton, and sewing the clothes. And those are very often not in decent work conditions.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great invitation almost to move beyond just descriptions of how people use particular objects or experiences for their identity.
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of question about who is labouring, in what conditions, etc., to try and bring them together and think, I think, a bit more sort of reflectively, both as a reader of the book and then also as a social scientist as well. And this, I think, brings us to the kind of the position that the book closes in, really. And there's a kind of sort of sad ending to the book, which, you know, you sort of say that the central theme in work, consumption, and capitalism is how work makes consumption, and the sad ending of the story is that markets seem inescapable. And obviously this has a relationship to the kind of moral, ethical dimensions, but I wonder, you know, why the downer at the end of the book?
I know, it's really cynical, isn't it? Maybe I was tired when I finished it. That seems really plausible. I guess I was feeling, the more I was looking at consumer capitalism, particularly when you're attending to the dynamics of work as well as to the dynamics of consumption, it seemed just more and more all-encompassing, more inescapable. So there's quite a long discussion in the book about emotion and about the way of working on emotion. And I mentioned that in the context of service work, but I think in the context of branded environments where feelings are captured and it's designed to capture feelings, it's a really significant part of our contemporary culture. So what do you persuade someone who has got a house full of stuff to spend their income on? Well, you give them experiences so they can go to, you know, Disneyland or something like that, and go on a Guinness tour. My favourite is the Wolfsburg factory for Volkswagen in Germany, where there are two enormous towers which are glass-fronted, which the cars, when they're finished, lifted up, and then they're shown before they're sent off to the person who's ordered them. And you can pay to go on that tour and be taken up in that lift. To feel what in relation to that brand? And irony that it's Volkswagen with all this emissions scandal that's been happening recently. So the kind of the capturing and the management of feeling, the capturing of experience and the remarketing of experience strike me as ever present. We see it in control of city public spaces and things like that. So I guess I felt like it's inescapable. We're sat here, I'm promoting my book. You're going to tweet about the podcast that I've done with it. We're, you know, working to create value for the publishers and consumerism, like, of many kinds, is so central to the operation of global capitalism. And it's at the heart of what I think is a debt-driven economy. So consumers encouraged to buy more with credit cards, with remortgaging their houses, etc. So it did feel like it's kind of inescapable. And there are some pleasures within consumption, let's not deny that, including the pleasures of working to do that. So to create an advert that you think is wonderful, there's a pleasure there. That's great. But I kind of got the feeling that consumerism captures so much of the life of the mind.
So where do you go next? Are you doing another project in this area, or, you know, you kind of settled your accounts with global capitalism and the market? What comes next?
I've got a couple of things that are related to this. One draws much more explicitly on the ideas of what kind of ethics are there in a market economy. And that's a project that looks at green workers. So in part, those are people who are often doing quite small business work with selling green baby products, for example, but also their environmental consultants. So I'm thinking about their private sector organisations, what kinds of ethics, what kinds of environmental ethics might emerge and might be compatible with the demands of profit making and profit maximisation, which we understand is so significant to global capitalism more generally. So understand how people position themselves as ethical actors in quite complex scenarios, what kinds of negotiations and what kinds of compromises they engage with. And then the other project, which is related to the themes of the book, is to look at higher education explicitly of creative industry workers. So people doing degrees in advertising design, media and communications and things like that, to understand how they are trained in the tacit skills, the explicit skills, the technological skills of the kind of work I'm talking about there, but also how they're persuaded to think about their working futures. So how is flexibility taught and embedded, or is it embedded in the curriculums that they're part of? And I think those pull out different themes that are within the book and that, yes, that I will be writing about in future.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I was talking to Dr. Lynn Pattinger about work, consumption and capitalism, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan.